Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A very important part of the war for the free world, of course, is the part that is under assault by communist China, namely Asia and other parts of the world beyond. The President of the United States has now for some time been promising a pivot to Asia in order to address this rising threat from the Chinese in various forms, economic as well as military. There hasn't been much to show for the pivot, but now there is going to be a trade arrangement with non-Chinese members of the Asian community, the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will constitute, by some accounts, the equivalent of a carrier battle group or more in terms of enhanced national security. To talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP as it's known, I'm very pleased to welcome back Rick Manning. Rick is the president of Americans for Limited Government, a very, very important organization in Washington these days. He formerly served as the public affairs chief at the Department of Labor during the George W. Bush administration and was with the National Rifle Association for a number of years. He's a columnist in The Hill, Investor's Business Daily, FoxNews.com, and elsewhere, and always a very, very welcome guest here. Thank you, Rick, for taking a few minutes to talk with us about the TPP and more.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You have been very forthright about the concerns that you have about this deal. Let me just hasten to say, we don't know all of the particulars yet. It hasn't been released, the final text. It was just agreed yesterday, finally. Based upon what we do know, what are your concerns?
Well, Frank, in any deal like this, and let me be clear, this is a deal between the United States and 11 other nations, including, and not just Asian nations, but Canada, Mexico, Chile, Peru, Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Brunei, Japan, Vietnam, and I think that's essentially the whole Ring of Fire is part of this deal. And it's with a lot of countries that have left out. The idea behind it is that they're going to create a trade partnership zone that will allow for free flow of goods and services, and through that economic freedom, allow for the growth of alliances that will effectively isolate the Chinese in terms of their attempt to create hegemony over the Asian Pacific region. The challenge is really on this is a number of areas. Number one, there is a real question as to how this thing's going to be governed. And I think all of your listeners should really take a look at the governance of any agreement, because that governance in and of itself is going to dictate what happens under that agreement. It's a, I'll give you a simple example. It's a 12-nation agreement, and if it's a simple majority in terms of finding somebody guilty under the terms of the agreement, then Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, Chile, Peru, and one other country, Mexico, could in fact find the United States guilty of violating the agreement and dramatically change our laws that we pass in a constitutional way. So there's a sovereignty issue. Secondly, the agreement has a provision that we've been told it has a provision based on people who looked at it before it was signed, that would allow the 12 countries to allow any other nation to join. And how that process is undertaken is significant, because it could in fact negate the congressional capacity to ratify the joining of any other nation with a treaty with the United States. So we're really concerned from a constitutional perspective, does this obviate U.S. constitutional sovereignty? And if it does, then Congress needs to say no.
The deck, again, as with the Iran deal, has been stacked against Congress saying no. And I'd like to come back to that in a moment with you, Rick Manning. But for the moment, staying with this issue of sovereignty, you've also pointed out that in addition to the free movement of goods and services, there is believed to be a commitment to the free movement of people as well. Against the backdrop of what we're already witnessing with respect to these so-called refugees, migrants, legal and illegal here and in Europe as well, what do you anticipate would be the repercussions of that commitment were it to be approved?
Well, I think with the free movement of people, you end up, obviously you end up with a question is whether or not we can even pretend to manage our borders under this agreement, recognizing that it does include both Canada and Mexico. For all intents and purposes, at that point, we've ceased to be a nation that has a firm border, and in fact would be able to, corporations and others would be able to just move employees around regardless of U.S. law. That's a point in the law that we're going to have to take a very close look at, because the devil's in the details. When you look at what has been released for an executive summary, there isn't necessarily the as strong of the concern, but anybody who's ever done anything in terms of what this administration's dealing with is, you have to look at what they're really doing, not what they sent out as a PR sheet. And I think there's a legitimate concern about that.
For sure. In that regard, Rick, as you've pointed out, and I have as well, the thing that's all the more mind-boggling is that the record of this administration, most recently, we just sort of mentioned the Iran debacle, the Obama bomb deal. But before that, you had everything from the New START treaty with the Russians, which was a fiasco, to the Bo Bergdahl swap. I mean, this is not an administration that has comported itself well in these negotiations, to say the very least. One of the questions, I guess, Rick, that is sort of implicit in something you just said about the way changes could be made, including adding new members to this accord, is the possibility that the country that it seems to be all about keeping out may nonetheless be allowed to come in to this kind of agreement, namely communist China. Do you think that's a distinct possibility? And if so, what might the implications of all this be?
I don't just think it's a distinct possibility. I think it's a probability. When you look at it, if the depending on what the rules are for allowing a country in, a simple majority of six, seven member nations could in fact say we want China into the deal. And if the U.S. doesn't agree, the U.S. is isolated in their own tree. And that's really the way this is likely, in my estimation, the most likely occurrence over time, is because there have been a lot of prohibitions on labor stuff and environmental stuff that have been put into this treaty to try to draw Democrat votes in the Senate and the House of Representatives. And yet, if China comes in and says, you don't have to follow any of that stuff, let's do the same terms of the deal, let us in, and you can trade with us, you can just ignore the United States. At that juncture, we've effectively negotiated China's taking over the region economically and not just militarily. So that's the real challenge here, is Congress has to be very smart about this. They have to look at it not just from a gee whiz, we're going to sell 10 more widgets to Vietnam perspective, but also is how does it play with it from a geopolitical perspective. Does it in fact create a noose that's around our neck where we end up giving away our capacity to manage our government, manage our economic policy, manage our trade policy, and giving it away to the whims of the Sultan of Brunei? I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we've got to take a look at. And anybody who says they trust President Obama to negotiate this based on U.S. best interests simply hasn't been paying attention to what's been going on the last 6 years.
For sure. Rick Manning, fortunately, you have been paying attention at Americans for Limited Government and in all of the outlets that you communicate, including this one, for which we're very grateful. Keep up this good work, my friend. It obviously is going to be difficult for Congress at this point, with fast-track authority having been given to the president to do the kind of vetting and careful consideration that you're talking about. But there do seem to be an awful lot of people who are opposed to the deal already, and I think there will be more the closer they get to look at the fine print. Again, keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Mike Gruntman about the Kremlin and missile defense, cheating in the past, and where is this likely to go in the future. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to be joined for the first time, I believe, by Dr. Mike Gruntman. He is a professor of astronautics at the University of Southern California. He founded USC's astronautics program. He is a prolific author and co-author of something over 200 publications. We're particularly excited to have a chance to talk with him about the most recent one, which is entitled Intercept 1961, The Birth of Soviet Missile Defense. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Glad to be here on your show, Frank.
Great. My pleasure as well. Let me ask you, first and foremost, about this new book, because I think it's a point of departure, if I can say, for what I'd love to talk to you about in a moment. But capture for us the essence of what took place in 1961 and its abiding significance.
Well, the book concentrates on the history of the events leading to the first intercept of a long-range ballistic missile in 1961, and also on some developments afterwards, and on key people and technical features of this development, providing some political context also. It reconstructs the sequence of the events, and what happened there is practically unknown in the Western world. And this was a truly spectacular and consequential achievement. It was really on par with such Soviet firsts of those days as the first intercontinental ballistic missile and the first satellite in 1957 and the first cosmonaut in 1961. And what is also important that it relied on advanced radar electronics and digital computing, the areas not usually viewed as particularly strong in the USSR. So, and what is also interesting, that this event is practically unknown, and at the same time, advances of Soviet weapons played a major role in driving development of U.S. defense programs and technologies. So for this knowledge of Soviet work, is really indispensable for understanding the Cold War and learning the lessons and applying them in today's world.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Gruntman from the University of Southern California. He is a preeminent figure in astronautics, both out there and nationwide, and the author of a new book entitled Intercept 1961, The Birth of Soviet Missile Defense. So, Dr. Gruntman, talk a bit about what the Soviets actually achieved in 1961 that was so consequential.
Well, this was the first time when an intermediate-range ballistic missile was intercepted and the warhead was destroyed, and it was a huge program emerged out of this first intercept. And I have to say that prior to that, the U.S. Army had intercepted four shorter-range missiles at White Sands in 1960. But the Soviets were the first to intercept a strategic missile and its warhead. And this work led directly to the further development and deployment of the operational missile defense systems of Moscow, A-35 in the early 1970s, and then its modernization, A-35M, in 1978, and finally led to the current system, A-135, that was deployed in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union already disintegrated.
Yeah. Now, Doctor, this was not a nuclear intercept, obviously, was it? This was something that was destroyed not by hitting it directly, but by blowing up something in proximity to it. Is that how it worked?
That's correct. This was the first non-nuclear intercept, but it was not a direct hit intercept. So the interceptor approached the target and then exploded at the right time, and it formed a field. It actually released more than 10,000 one-inch spheres, and each sphere had a hard core, and the remaining part was an explosive. So it released more than 10,000 such spheres, and they formed a disc approximately 500 feet in diameter. And the warhead hit a few of such spheres and was destroyed by the explosion of these small spheres. So this was not a direct intercept, and although the Soviets now proudly claim in all the, or the Russians, I should say, in their publications that the United States was able
to repeat a non-nuclear intercept only 23 years later.
Though ours, as I recall, actually kinetically intercepted the target, not just through this technique, but theirs was certainly effective. Let me ask you, Dr. Gruntman, because a lifetime ago I was in the Pentagon and worked on these missile defense issues, and at the time was making the case that the Soviets, as they were then called, were very assiduously pursuing missile defense and had evidence that they were not simply protecting Moscow, which they were permitted to do under the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, but they were actually building a territorial defense. I know this is beyond the time that you focused on in your new book, Intercept 1961, but what are your thoughts on what the Soviets wound up doing and for that matter, what the Russians have inherited from their time?
There were attempts to develop also territorial defense systems, and actually it was the late 1960s. At the same time, they were working full steam on developing of what would become A-35, the system for Moscow, but they also simultaneously tried to develop territorial defense systems. It did not work. The proposals were never approved, and actually the frictions in the Soviet defense establishment led to the finally firing of the person who led the first non-nuclear intercept and who was in charge of the development of A-35 for Moscow. But they never were able to develop a territorial defense system. And also there was a realization around 1970 that missile defense system probably cannot protect against a massive attack by a sophisticated adversary. So it should rather be focused on, say, accidental launch or maybe a launch from a nuclear submarine that is out of the control of the national authority or something like that.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm familiar with this sort of depiction. And yet, well after 1970, 72 for that matter, the ABM Treaty, the Russians were building, among other things, as you know, the Krasnoyarsk radar in a location of Russia that was not permitted under the terms of the treaty and that seemed very much to be of a piece with a larger territorial defense of not all of the Soviet Union, but the parts of it that they cared about, a preferential defense. Do you disagree with that characterization of what the Krasnoyarsk radar was about?
This was certainly for the missile defense purposes that was not allowed by the treaty, because it was looking for defense of a broader area, certainly not a point.
Clear-cut violation of the treaty, absolutely.
There is no question about that. And actually, a lot of recollections of the key players in the Russian missile defense that appeared, a number of people just think, yeah, it was a clear violation, it was a stupid thing to do, but others just think, who cares about the treaties, which was the standard attitude in the Soviet Union. You don't sign a treaty to follow that.
Yes, still to this day, it seems. That's an inherited trait from the Soviet era by Vladimir Putin. Doctor, this is a very, very important conversation, especially as it relates to, you know, the future of deterrence, and I would be very grateful if we might have a chance to visit further about it in the near future. In the meantime, we're hard out of time. Thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on the publication of your new book, Intercept 1961, The Birth of Soviet Missile Defense. Dr. Mike Gruntman of the University of Southern California, come back to us again soon. Patrick Poole joins us next, investigative reporter, talking about Russia in Syria and what's up in Egypt at the moment and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The good news about the just-concluded Trans-Pacific Partnership is that it excludes China. The bad news is that at least some of what it includes may be contrary to our national interests and sovereignty. The details of this accord won't be revealed for weeks. Still, the process by which it was negotiated and reports about its contents raise concerns. U.S. and Asian governments were joined by various companies to negotiate the TPP in secret and with negligible transparency or accountability. Not surprisingly, they came up with arrangements that suit those parochial interests at the expense of our nations. The deal also reportedly involves commitments to the free movement of people and to transnational governing arrangements utterly at odds with our sovereign republic and constitution. Unfortunately, Congress can only take it or leave it. At this point, leaving the TPP seems advisable. This is Frank Gaffney.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Last week, the Obama bomb, Iran nuclear deal survived votes in the House and Senate with zero Republican support. The Obama administration and their supporters are trying to discount a powerful Republican criticism of this deal that there are secret side deals allowing Iran to inspect itself for nuclear activities. Critics claim the failure to provide these deals to Congress means the clock for congressional review never started and Obama cannot lift sanctions against Iran. Obama officials claim the side deals argument is a distraction, that these deals are not part of the nuclear agreement, and that they are part of a normal and private arrangement between the IAEA and Iran. The side deals are not a normal arrangement, and there are strong indications they were written by the Obama administration and hidden in secret side deals to conceal them from Congress. The side deals are not a distraction. They constitute national security fraud. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Patrick Poole, one of our time's most impressive and accomplished investigative reporters, among other things. He is an expert on counterterrorism. He blogs and writes and otherwise comments at PJ Media. He is also a man who has been recently in Egypt, and we'll talk with him in a moment about his travels, his experiences, his insights into the conflict there. But let me first properly welcome him. Patrick, good to have you with us as always. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be back with you.
Before we get to Egypt, I thought maybe we might start a little bit of a conversation with respect to your insights into what is happening in Syria at the moment. Some of the same actors, I guess, are at work in both places, the Muslim Brotherhood notably. But we have the Russians engaged, as you know now, and going after what we're told are the moderates that the Obama administration has long been cultivating with very checkered results.
I think what we're seeing with the Russian intervention in Syria is that it's kind of shifted the playing field. The Russians have been bombing the north-south highway that runs basically from Aleppo down to Damascus. So they're beginning to clear the way from Hama and Homs, basically the major population centers in the western part of the country, which is Assad's stronghold. And what we're with these bombings and all of the hand-wringing and pearl-clutching about the groups that are being bombed, I think what it exposes is the fact that these so-called vetted moderate groups are in an alliance called Jaish al-Fatah with Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's official affiliate in Syria, as well as with Ahrar al-Sham, which is another branding of al-Qaeda in Syria.
So those would be the moderate al-Qaeda guys that the administration occasionally has indicated it wants to visit with, right?
Exactly. And there's an article in Foreign Affairs Today that talks about the fact that Jabhat al-Nusra has tried to rebrand itself, and they've allied with these so-called moderate groups, such as the takeover of Idlib here several months ago, as cover, trying to basically repackage themselves that, hey, we're the moderate alternative to ISIS, which, of course, as you know, Frank, we've seen this time and again where, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is the moderate alternative to al-Qaeda. Now we're at, you know, we're the moderate alternative, you know, al-Qaeda's the moderate alternative to ISIS. I mean, it's just insanity. And so we're seeing that there's a lot of mobilization of ground troops along the coast, and it looks like Russia and the Assad regime are going to make a counteroffensive here to take back some of this territory.
We're joined, it sounds, Patrick Poole, by ground forces of Iran as well. I'm not sure whether those are Quds Force folks or whether those are the broader Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps or whether they're Hezbollah or some combination of the three. Do you have any reading on that? And how is that likely to translate into the further rolling up of these so-called Free Syrian Army moderate types and al-Qaeda on the one hand, and will they ultimately come to blows with the Islamic State as well, do you think?
Well, Hezbollah has been active in the along the Kalamoon Mountain border range with Lebanon and in other places. And, of course, Iran has been Assad is a client state of Iran. And so, you know, we've seen various, you know, IRGC, Quds Force, et cetera, active there. And I'm sure that they're going to take on a more increased presence and now that the Russians have arrived. So, you know, I think we're in for a battle. And, of course, as we've seen already this week, the Russian planes reportedly flying into Turkish airspace, Turkey being a NATO ally, and Erdogan, who's three-quarters crazy to begin with, decides to, you know, to take on Putin, and, you know, next thing you know, the United States is in World War III, most likely on the wrong side, you know, and everybody's going to be scratching their head wondering how this all happened.
You know, I speculated yesterday that we may well be at the cusp of a nuclear war in that region, and I don't think that's an exaggeration, Patrick. This thing could rocket out of control. Patrick, before we run out of time, I do want to ask you about your recent trip to Egypt. You've spent some time there now, meeting with government officials at the highest levels, as I understand it, and have an appreciation for, talk about being on the wrong side, the kind of status of American relations with Egypt at the moment in light of the past support that the Obama administration gave to the Muslim Brotherhood and the diffidence. I think it's charitable to call it diffidence, but the diffidence, shall we say, of the administration towards the al-Sisi government. What's going on with respect to Egypt at the moment in Sinai and in the main core heart of Cairo and so on, but also more broadly, where do you think we're going with our relationship with the Egyptians?
Well, Egypt has been conducting an ongoing counterterror operation, not just in the Sinai, but in the Western Desert and in Upper Egypt, and with some success. And interestingly, when we arrived in Egypt here about a month ago, President Sisi had just returned from Russia and was on his way to Asia, where he was in China and some several other countries out that way. So I think, and the fallout of those meetings with Russia, where they're going to be getting more hardware, military hardware from the Russians, helicopters, two frigates. Of course, they have the new lane of the Suez Canal that will accommodate two-way traffic, which they're very proud about. And interestingly, I think the sense of the Egyptians is they're still very pro-American, but they absolutely hate the Obama regime because they feel like they've been betrayed. And of course, Obama went to Cairo in June 2009 and talked about democracy. Well, you know, on June 30th, 2013, you had 30 million people in the streets in opposition, the largest protests in recorded human history. And you had the administration continuing to, you know, thumb its nose at the actions of, you know, the refusal of the Egyptian people to endure the Muslim Brotherhood tyranny. I mean, there's no other way to put it. You know, Morsi declared himself above the law.
It was a Sharia program, full stop.
Exactly. And they're done. I mean, that's the sense. I talked with a lot of working class Egyptians, some of whom voted for the Muslim Brotherhood in 2012, voted for Morsi. And the sense is Egypt is done with the Brotherhood. And their overriding fear is that they may end the Brotherhood. And in fact, there was a shootout in Alexandria just here last week that killed several Brotherhood leaders. And they found stacks of AK-47s in the apartments. And we'll see how these parliamentary elections turn out. Honestly, you know, we see the D.C. think tank crowd, you know, hand-wringing about President Sisi, but in fact, you know, talking about, you know, his government, and he is overwhelmingly popular there. He doesn't need to fix elections. I think he's pretty secure as long as they continue to take the battle to these forces in Sinai and these jihadist forces and the Brotherhood, who's still continuing to very openly causing trouble.
Patrick Poole, nobody understands that better than you, and you help so many of the rest of us understand it so well at PJ Media and in other outlets. I appreciate you taking a little bit of time. Let me also just thank you for your work with us in the Sharia, the Threat to America volume by Team B2, to which you contributed substantially. We look forward to visiting with you further and early on, as many of these developments are going to be very, very dynamic, I think. But in the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll be speaking with Ryan Morrow. We'll take stock with him of what he's making of some of these same threats, including here in the United States. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Fred Fleitz for the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration's efforts to defend the controversial nuclear deal with Iran has become ugly, very ugly. Last week, during a speech at American University, the president portrayed opponents of the deal as partisan Republicans in common cause with Death to America chanting Iranian hardliners. The Tablet, a daily online Jewish magazine, ran an editorial on August 7th claiming that the president is using code anti-Semitic language to criticize Jewish Americans for opposing the Iran deal and to blame them if the deal is rejected by Congress. Some liberal pro-Obama groups have gone further and have questioned the loyalty to this country of Jewish members of Congress who oppose the deal, such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. The president and his supporters are stooping to smearing opponents of the deal because the agreement is so awful and they cannot defend it on its merits. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by another eminent figure in the effort to both understand the nature of the enemy we confront in the global jihad movement and to establish the sorts of things that must be done to protect our country, our civilization, and our people against the threat Islamic supremacism represents. He is Ryan Morrow. Today he is a national security analyst for the Clarion Project. He is a gifted writer and has published widely and been frequently featured at Fox News, where he is turned to assess many of these issues that we're interested in talking with him about today, notably the state of the global jihad abroad and here at home. Ryan Morrow, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
You have written recently about an important report out of a House committee focused on this challenge of what's been called counterterrorism. I think of it as a much bigger deal than that because it's not just the violent form of terror that we're up against, of course. But talk a little bit about the findings of this committee report and what should be the takeaway for the rest of us.
The House Homeland Security Committee released this report that focused just on the terrorist and foreign fighter threat, not the greater ideological threat so much, but it was still really alarming with almost every other sentence just having some jaw-dropping statement. And one of the biggest ones was, quote, "Today we are witnessing the largest global convergence of jihads in history." And the numbers they gave is, we all know what resulted from the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And there were only about 10,000 foreign fighters during that entire 10-year period in Syria today. The fight has been going on for about 4 years. And just right now, there are 25,000 foreign fighters. So we're looking at a really dramatic threat from there.
Let me ask you about what you make of the relationship between the jihadists of the Sunni stripe and the jihadists of the Shiite stripe, particularly, Ryan, as we're watching the Russians, it seems, trying to build an axis of the Shiites against the Sunnis to protect themselves against Sunni advances in Russia and the former Soviet Union. Is there a chance that that won't work because these guys will make common cause as they have in the past?
That's been the pattern, is that they kill each other and then they also work together. So even right now, there's an Al-Qaeda pipeline operating through the Iranian regime's territory. Iran is sponsoring the Taliban in Afghanistan. And all of this inconsistency doesn't make sense to the American mindset, but it makes perfect sense over in that part of the world. It's fine to them to kill each other in one theater and then work together in another. Plus, even if they are fighting each other in a certain area, you see, wherever radical Shiite influence grows, where Iranian influence grows, you immediately see Al-Qaeda and ISIS influence grow. So one feeds off the other. And you're going to see that spill over into America as well. One other fact from the report that is worth mentioning is that of the Americans who have traveled overseas to join jihadists, several dozen managed to make it back into America after joining jihadists and fighting with them overseas in Syria.
Are you saying that you see the rise of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda where the Shiite jihadists are operating in response to the threat that Sunnis perceive from the Shiites, or at least in some cases, is it as a result of collaboration between the Iranian regime, let's say, and these jihadists of the Sunni character?
It's both. In some cases, like in Afghanistan, you have Iran actually sponsoring the Taliban. Sometimes they cynically want the Sunni jihadists to rise up so that they can position themselves as the moderate solution. And then in other cases, like in Yemen, wherever Iranian influence rises up, then you will see this reaction where Al-Qaeda and ISIS see that as a political opportunity.
Very interesting. On the Clarion Project website, and again, we're speaking with Ryan Morrow, who is a national security analyst for that important group. There's a reference to a Saudi cleric call for jihad against the Russians. Do you credit that report? And if so, what might that mean for what the Russians are up to at the moment?
Well, the parallel here for jihadists around the world is that this is Afghanistan all over again, like I alluded to before. And so for them, this is their moment again. The fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan is one of their crowning achievements. And so they're seeing a parallel here that's very encouraging to them. And when you look at polls, there's just a massive amount of support for jihadists like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, of people who support them but have not yet been activated, who have not actually picked up the gun. And so this could be the trigger. Having Russian forces in Syria, having Saudi clerics saying, go there and fight them. And if you look at the Syrian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood's website right now, they are also endorsing this call for jihad.
Do you anticipate that this is going to become the classic morass for the Russians that their Soviet predecessors found in Afghanistan?
I would assume that they've learned some lessons from that, and what they will do is have special forces on the ground but not actually occupy territory. They can use the Iranians and Hezbollah for that and what's left of Assad's forces. I doubt that they would be reckless enough to actually go and seize territory, and then you have Russian troops patrolling the streets. But who knows? They are determined to save the Assad regime at virtually any cost. And that's just one of the realities here, is that the Assad regime is not going to go away now.
Let me turn to the domestic challenge. You've alluded to the problem of violent jihadists coming into this country. Talk a little bit about one other facet of this, which you're deeply expert in, Ryan Morrow, and that is the civilization jihad, as the Muslim Brotherhood calls it. One of their front groups, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, has been in the news of late, calling for Dr. Ben Carson to withdraw from the Republican presidential race. He's now responded in kind that they should not have a tax-exempt status if they're engaged in this kind of political activity. What is the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, all about, and how serious a problem do you think this civilization jihad represents inside America?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Justice Department don't agree on much, but they do agree on something, which is that CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, is an entity of the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood. So we know for a fact that that's the case. This is a group that was set up as basically the PR arm of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States in order to advance the agenda of Hamas, believing that this would have less fingerprints than the other organizations that they were using. And we know that from FBI wiretaps and internal Muslim Brotherhood documents.
So when we're told this is just a civil rights organization, that would be a fraud being perpetrated on the American people?
Right. This is a political organization. And this is proof of that. This is proof that this isn't about standing up for so-called oppressed Muslims in the United States. This is a political organization meant to influence policy and public opinion.
And how serious as a facet of this larger, I don't think of it so much as nonviolent jihad as pre-violent jihad, does what the Council on American Islamic Relations and for that matter, the Islamic Society of North America and the Muslim Public Affairs Council and Muslim advocates and so on, what these groups are all engaged in, Ryan Morrow?
Well, it's what you referred to before as the civilization jihad, which is the, at least for now, the nonviolent arm of the jihad. Very often when we talk about jihad, everyone thinks of suicide bombings and people being beheaded. But when you look at Sharia doctrine about this, there's many other things that go along with jihad, and it includes political warfare, dawah, all sorts of different facets, as any ideological warfare should be pursued. And what's interesting to me about this episode with Ben Carson is that when you look at what the IRS website says, it says explicitly that those with this tax-exempt status cannot explicitly declare their endorsement of a candidate or opposition to a candidate for office. They can criticize a candidate, warn about the consequences of their policies, but they can't say, we as an organization oppose a candidacy. And that's what they did with Ben Carson. And what does that say about how they're feeling right now, that they know that this is the law and they said, hey, we can break it. It doesn't really matter.
Ryan Morrow, it is always a terrific pleasure to have you with us, and I hope you'll come back to us soon on both of these accounts. The global jihad movement is clearly on the march. We need to understand its activities here at home of the stealthy kind, or at least as dangerous as the other. Come back to us, as I say, very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.